From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thoughts. I'm Virginia Prescott with Tina Clark.
Gee, it's great after being out late, walking my baby back home. Arm in arm over meadow and farm, walking my baby back home.
Tina's new memoir, Southern Discomfort, recalls growing up in rural Mississippi during the Jim Crow era. Her real-life childhood reads like a Southern Gothic novel. More than once, she watched her mother in an alcoholic fury chasing her father, a successful, blatantly unfaithful husband, with a gun. Tina Clark came out and eventually left her small town for a big career in music. She produced records with Aretha Franklin, Natalie Cole's Grammy Award-winning Still Unforgettable. We're hearing a song from that now. Movie soundtracks and jingles. Perhaps you've heard of this one.
There's one place that's on your way. McDonald's is your break today. Have you had your break today? Easy does it McDonald's way.
What a road, Tina. And how fascinating hearing how you got here. Well, you yourself, I mean, you witnessed your parents fighting. The scenes are very distinct.
I think the things that you see as a child and growing up, they don't really leave you. And these scenes never left me, but they became maybe comical at some point instead of as painful.
But you observe your mom and your mother and father. Everything looked perfect from the outside. In fact, that was a big concern of theirs, that things looked good from the outside. But you knew your mom was not completely content in her beautiful house. What were you picking up on from her?
Well, I think that, I mean, my mom was my shero. She ended up being my shero and my best friend. But she, you know, was an aspiring songwriter. She had married my father. She was 15, he was 19. And she was very artistic. And she, you know, that was an outlet for her that she wanted. But that was one thing that he didn't know anything about music. He was a businessman. He was a self-taught, self-made, very, very successful, wealthy businessman. And anything that had to do with music or arts was just crazy stuff, you know, to him. So it did not go over well at all, my mother going to New Orleans to try to expand her writing career. She wrote with Leon Kellner, who was the orchestra leader at the Blue Room. And my mother, you know, never had success other than just a local kind of success. I have a ton of her 78s, but, you know, she was made to feel so important when she walked in there, because the orchestra would stop and he would say, "Ladies and gentlemen," and he would announce her in a song and the band would start playing. That's what she thrived for, but it was always squashed. And, you know, she wanted to pursue her music and she wanted my father to be faithful. And she never really got either.
And she she used alcohol a lot. She was often drinking, drunk when you were growing up, which made it completely unpredictable inside mm-hmm. of your household. You said you just wanted calm. And I'm guessing you were walking on eggshells and you internalized that somehow this was your fault. How do you think that lived in you?
Well, I think I've always been an eternal optimist, even to fault sometimes. But this is a funny little story, but my mother told me the whole time I was growing up that, because I have three older sisters who are much older than me. And when they had me, my mother said I was the save the marriage baby that didn't save the marriage. So that starts you out at zero right there. And so you can only go up from there. So, you know, they divorced when I was 10. And as you'll read in the book, she left on my 10th birthday. And I used to think years ago, I grew up, really, I didn't want to celebrate any birthdays. And now I realize, And I wish more people, and women particularly, would realize that when you get that courage, when you have settled for so long in a relationship situation, and you've stayed because of money or power or whatever it may be, fear, or you're not educated. My mother, she was in the eighth grade when they got married, and that was it. And to be married to the most powerful man in that little town and all of these things. But after 28 years, it happened to be on my birthday. That's the way I look at it.
Well, I had the sense that you were kind of adultified very early.
Very early.
You were even driving at 12, right?
Yeah, I got my first car at 12. I was given a... So, first of all, when I was adultified, I guess I've never used that word before.
Nor have I, but it seemed to work somehow.
I when she left on my 10th birthday, and it was on the 19th of December, and my father had, you know, he wasn't settled with the shock of her leaving, but he realized she was really gone. He dropped me off at the corner of the little front street town where I grew up and gave me a $100 bill, which my dad carried always wads of $100 bills on him. And he handed me a $100 bill and said, okay, go shopping for your sisters and whatever else you need to get anybody. And I remember him pulling off, and it was cold, and I was standing there, and I was right then at that moment, I believe that I made a decision and thought, okay, I'm not going to be sideswiped anymore with all these surprises and this volatile family and everything that's going on around it. It's time for me to buck up. I got to take care of myself, and I got to make my own decisions. And I mean, it's like I played all this out in my head. And I think that's when things changed for me that day, because up until that day, even with my mother being soused most of the time, everybody took care of me. You know, everything was done for me when I was little. But I was 10 years old now and was dropped off and my mother was gone. And it was like, okay, time to buck up. And that's what I did.
And that was also in December of 1963. So a month after John Kennedy had been assassinated.
Everything happened, it seemed like. It really did. It seemed like everything happened that year.
Well, so much was tumbling out at that time. You know, the throes of the civil rights movement just to come, and the violence, the disruption in American culture, which did not seem to reach Waynesboro for the most part. RFK's assassination, MLK, not much of a flicker in Waynesboro where you were. But you, Tina, you were a scrapper. You were a fighter, it seems like to me. You insisted that Virgie come and sit with you at the lunch counter and up in the front instead of out in the back door.
Virgie, my nanny.
Right. Her daughter, Cindy, you brought her when they were registering, secretly taking donations for the Klan, which you realize was really endangering them. It's really painful to read these now, you know, the mm-hmm. discomfort that they had. One misstep on their part could have been deadly for them. I'm trying to get at, did you have this just elevated sense of yourself? Because you were the daughter of this incredibly powerful man.
Absolutely. I didn't realize that then. But I think looking back on it as I got older, absolutely, I felt that was my insurance. You know, when I stand up to the Klan, or when I bring a black person, my beloved, you know, Virgie, into the restaurant and integrate a restaurant for the first time in this little town, the only person I'm going to have to answer to is my daddy. Because anybody else, I mean, they know that I'm his daughter. So, yes, I did have that sense of security, and that's just being totally honest and transparent. My thought process at that age, I wanted them to have equality. I wanted Virgie to... who had never been in a restaurant in her entire life and be actually served a meal that she wasn't serving, I thought this would be the greatest thing in the world for me to be the one to take this person I love so much into that restaurant and see her be served and not have to clean up the dishes. I thought with Cindy, I wanted to show these people in these white robes that a black person and a white person could sit in the front seat and they weren't going to do a damn thing about it. So in my heart was the right thing. But then I realized when we walked out of that restaurant and after everything that had happened, which you can read about in the book, I realized that I had put her in grave danger. Not only had I put her in grave danger, but I had pulled a very wonderful, shy human being. All she cared about was taking care of me, taking care of her children in her little home, her shack that she had 9 children in. Never wanted to be noticed. And pulling her into that equality, what I thought actually was devastating, and I put her in a very dangerous place. And when I look back on it now, it saddens me greatly because I feel like it was selfish. I had an agenda. I wanted to prove something. I wanted to do it for her, but I wanted to do it for me too, I think. That's, I wanted to see her be treated equally.
We're hearing some of the reflection on the life of Tina Clark by Tina Clark, who's written a memoir called Southern Discomfort. It's about growing up in the South in the 1950s and 1960s. I'm curious about how you got started in the music business. You talked about how your mom loved music. She aspired to make records, did make some records. How did it come to you?
From the time I can remember, very, very young, my mother was always in her bedroom listening to, she had a turntable in her bedroom. She was always listening to Nat King Cole, Billie Holiday, Ella Fitzgerald, Ray Charles, Louis Armstrong, Sarah Vaughan, on and on and on. And I just grew up with that. I think, well, I know that it seeped inside my soul. And she said when I was even in the crib that I was constantly doing rhythms on the crib. And I guess that's how she knew I was going to be a drummer one day. But I used to beat on everything. Anything that I could hold, forks, knives, my hands, whatever. I was always playing rhythms until I actually started playing the drums.
So it was an encounter, I guess, with Stevie Wonder, if I read your history right?
Yes,
that,
I mean,
that
I was...
got you kind of launched?
I won't say that he launched my career. He gave me... He launched, I think, inside of me that instead of being a drummer, a musician, that I really wanted to be a writer, a songwriter. I had graduated from college. I was on the road with my band. We were touring. You know, the first place we came was Atlanta, Georgia. I remember I walked off the stage. My dad said that at graduation, I had wanted to quit 2 years before and move to L.A. with a band. And he told me that if I did that, he would never be there for me to fall back onto because I needed a degree, which was good advice, he said. But he said, because when this music foolishness that you're doing doesn't happen, at least you'll have a steady job and something that's a real career. Because to him, back then, women could only be, and not only be because I'm not saying it in that way, but women could be teachers. They could be what they called back then, secretaries. They could be...
Nurses?
Nurses, bank tellers. But, you know, there was a limit to this this career stuff, right? And he felt good because I got my degree, but I literally only got it because of him. So when I walked off the stage, I walked over, handed him my diploma, and gave him a hug, went out to, my band was waiting with a van and a U-Haul trailer, and we took off to Atlanta, Georgia. That was our first gig, and that was in 1975, I think. So I was on the road for several years, and at the time I was playing it, I was a house band in Biloxi, Mississippi, on the beach at a club. But I was also working part-time in Bogalusa, Louisiana, as a second engineer at, I think it was called Studio in the Country. Well, lo and behold, Stevie Wonder comes to record there. And so we just hit it off. And, you know, before he went back, he surprised me and came to this club to hear me play one night. And I was so nervous when he walked in and I saw it was him, because everybody had been talking about how I played the drums. And my leg was shaking so bad, I think I was doing triplets on the bass drum with my foot. When he went back to L.A., he had someone to call me and say, do you want to come and hang out? I'm getting ready to cut a new album. I think you should come out here. Check it out. And I said, well, I don't have any money. I play in a band. How am I going to come to L.A.? And he goes, I'll buy you an airline ticket. I'll buy it one way. When you're ready to go back, you let me know, and you can stay as long as you want. So I went out to L.A. But before I went to my dad.
I can only imagine what your dad said.
I was so excited. You know, and they were divorced by then, of course, way divorced. And my mother was so excited because, of course, she knew who Stevie Wonder was. And she was like, you know, go, go, Hercules, Hercules, go, go. Run, Forrest, run. And my dad, so I was so excited. And I went to my dad and I was like, now, Daddy, I'm going to L.A. with Stevie Wonder. Well, he didn't have a clue of who Stevie Wonder was.
Mm-hmm.
But he had already heard the rumor. Can't imagine from who. Mm. But he had already heard the rumor about this. So somebody had told him that this man was a black man. So all he thought in his head, now you got to realize he knows I'm gay, but I don't even think he even computed what that really meant. All he computed was, I was going to California with a black man, and I had fallen in love with this black man and going to California. And he was beside himself. He was livid. And so he said, if you go to California with that man, I will disown you right now from my will. And I looked at him and I said, see you, Daddy.
Tina Clark, we're so glad you're here. What a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been awesome.
And that is it for our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and The Raven Taylor. Our engineer is Alex Word, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us today. This is On Second Thought.